Hi, Eleanor. I'm Michael.
How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for asking. Oh, one question. Where am I? Who are you and what's going on?
Right. So, you, Eleanor Shellstrop, are dead. Your life on Earth has ended, and you are now in the next phase of your existence in the universe.
Cool. Cool. I have some questions.
Thought you might.
Michael Schur, creator of The Good Place, is here with me to answer all of your burning questions about life, death, and most importantly, comedy. It's The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. For this week's show, we're taking you inside the brand new office of the man who not only wrote and produced The Office, but also created Parks and Recreation, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and The Good Place, which will air its highly anticipated series finale at the end of this month. Even though you may recognize him as Mo Schrute from The Office, Michael Schur isn't quite a household name. And yet he's directly responsible for some of the funniest and most popular comedy of the past two decades, starting with his first ever TV job as a young writer for Saturday Night Live. Along with Adam McKay and Tina Fey, he wrote some of the best political sketches during the Will Ferrell as George W. Bush era. We talk about all of that, including the endgame for The Good Place and a possible future for The Office on NBC's new streaming service, Peacock. Quick note before we get to the good stuff. If you like this podcast, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think. You can also go to ratethispodcast.com/laugh to rate this podcast wherever you listen. Now, let's get to my conversation with Michael Schur.
Well, thank you for having us in your office.
You're welcome. You're the first people to be in this office.
Oh, wow. So you just moved offices.
Just moved next door to where I was before, and it's a lot nicer in here.
Yeah,
you can't tell because it's messy, but it's a lot nicer in here than it was in the other one.
Was there a reason for the move, just changing it up? Or
There were several. My old office had a... I would call it a vermin problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was old and beaten up
and
sad. And they were redoing this one. And I was like, hey, I have an idea. What if I move in there? Also, here's a side note. So when I moved into that office, I got mail for Brett Ratner all the time.
Oh, well, that's not like, fun.
Oh, cool. I have
Brett
Ratner.
Was it nice mail or?
It was like a lot of auction catalogs and like stuff like that. And I once got an application for a home equity loan. And I was like, ooh, I could apply for a home equity loan for Brett Ratner and then like give all the money to Rain or something like that. And then I was like, well, I'll probably go to jail for fraud, so I shouldn't do that. But then I told everybody, like my joke for a long time was, I have Brett Ratner's old office. They wanted to find someone whose like vibe was the most similar to Brett Ratner, so they put me in there. And I told that to everybody. And then I ran into this guy who's been on Universal for a long time, and he was like, "Oh, you're in Brett Ratner's old office?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "You know who had that before him?" And I said, "No, who?" And he goes, "Bill Cosby." Like, cool. So, needless
Real
to say,
when
the opportunity came to move, I jumped at it.
Yeah, and hopefully a new couch too.
Yeah, new mojo, new everything.
We are here about a couple weeks before the series finale of The Good Place is about to air.
That's
so
right.
How are you feeling as this time in your life is kind of coming to a close?
Endings are hard emotionally, but I feel good. We made the decision after the third season to bring the show to a close. And there have been many days since then where I've felt sad about that, but I've never felt regret, which I think is the key. I was worried that I would feel regret,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't, and up to and including this moment now. So that is that I feel good about. Like it was the right decision. I'm happy that we did it that way. I think the show ended exactly the way we were, in a very rare way, able to execute the show from beginning to end exactly the way we wanted to. So any complaints are entirely my fault.
Yeah, so it was your decision to end it after four seasons. That was kind of, it wasn't coming from the network that they said you had to wrap it up.
Not at all. It was us. After the show got picked up for season two, which was a good indication that it would be a viable concern going forward, I immediately started thinking about how long it should last. Mm-hmm. And I talked about it with the writers for all of season two and all of season three. And the initial thought I had was, I think it's about 50 episodes. Mm-hmm. Like the show from the beginning has moved very, very quickly and chewed up a lot of story. And I knew that it wasn't a sort of like, let's see how long we can make this mm-hmm. last kind of show. And somehow like the number 50 just stuck in my head, which would have been about four seasons. And I got to the end of season two and still felt the same way. And then in season three, I really started thinking about it as we broke out that season. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed like, yeah, like that was the number. Like it just, that's how long the story should be. And so when season three ended, we spent all of season three doing gut checks constantly of like, is this the right pace? Are we moving too quickly? Are we moving too slowly? And then by the end of season three, it was like, yeah, this is it. So told the network, told the cast, and headed into season four, knowing that we were in the official sort of end game. And that was very freeing. And when I first pitched the show, one of the first people I pitched it to was Damon Lindelof. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, what am I worried about? What should I be worried about? What are the pitfalls here? Yeah. And he said a number of things, but the one that really stuck with me was like, when you're doing a show like this, if you don't know where you're going, you're in trouble. Like if things are like open-ended, mm-hmm. that's when you will sort of run off the rails. Yeah.
Do you think he was speaking about that from personal experience?
He was, and he said he was like, you know, and I think if you look at Lost specifically, the period of time where like they seemed like they were at sea is the same time the audience kind of drifted away mm-hmm, a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then once that story came out, I think they, in my memory at least, they were the first people to do this. They went to the network and were like, we need to end the show.
Yeah, that's what...
And as soon as they made that decision, the show just started. Mm-hmm. It felt like it did at the beginning where it was like,
no one had really done that before. Like, canceled their own show essentially.
Yeah. And what a bold thing to do for a show that is an international phenomenon, you know? And so he was just like, you just always have to know where you're going.
Yeah.
And so we will have gotten to the end of this 4-year long project without ever not knowing where we were going. Mm. And that is a huge relief.
Yeah. I do think Lost is obviously a line in the sand in that way, but also in the sense of the type of show that it is and the way that fans interact with it. And it is this kind of difference between an old model of TV, which you've spent a lot of time in, where it's like, it's just, we like hanging out with these people at The Office or, you know, in Parks and Rec, Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And so you obviously, you know, made a conscious decision to do something different with this show. So can you talk about going back to the beginning, why you wanted to do something so radically different from what you'd been doing before that?
Well, partly just because it was different. Like when Parks and Rec ended and Brooklyn was up and running, Dan Gore was fully running Brooklyn at the time. And I was sort of like, all right, what's next? I sort of thought to myself, well, I could do the same thing. I could try to come up with a premise that amounts to a collection of goofballs in an office. Mm-hmm. And I could try to hang out with those goofballs as long as it was economically and creatively viable. And that's a really fun way to live, like as a writer. There's nothing wrong with that. But I had just done it. That's the only thing I had done. Mm-hmm. I started on The Office out here, and then it was Parks and Rec, and then it was Brooklyn. And it just had been, at the time, it had been whatever, 10 or 12 years mm-hmm. of the same formula. And so it was pure, just like creative expansion or something. Mm-hmm. That's all it was. It was like, maybe I should try a different kind of show.
Yeah.
And that there's nothing behind it other than, other than that. And I there were other versions that I thought about. Like I thought about a family show because at the time the people running NBC were really keen on trying to like NBC hasn't been known recently for family shows.
Right.
It's been mostly workplace shows. And they were really intent on trying to find a family show that worked. The problem is that I'm a white guy from suburban Connecticut, and I don't think there's really anything that interesting about my family.
Yeah.
And so every version of that I could conceive of as being something that I could authentically write was real boring. Mm-hmm. and in general, I think I feel like at this point in the history of television, like the white family has been pretty,
it's been done.
It's pretty well explored. And then this premise, which had been floating around in my brain for a while, kind of kept bubbling back up. And usually that's a sign that it's something that you should focus on. So that was really there was nothing more complicated about the decision than that.
And I think NBC did kind of jump at the idea of this higher concept thing too, because that's also was kind of becoming a trend.
Yeah,
when you started this
it show. Was and TV has expanded its palette even in the network world to allow for big ideas like this. And I've said this before, but when I was considering this premise, Last Man on Earth had been on for I think at least one season, maybe two. And it gave me a lot of hope because it was like, that's a network show.
Yeah.
And that's a wild premise. Like, that is not a
weird
premise.
Weird
show with like a really big idea behind it that existed and was successful and people liked, and it was on Fox. And so, I think that it was the sort of right idea, right place, right time for a number of different reasons, ranging from the way in which network TV, like even this new era of TV had even expanded into like traditional networks to allow for it, for something like this to exist.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about the casting from the beginning, because I think that's just so essential to a show like this, that you have a cast that works. And I know you worked with Allison Jones, right?
Who's
kind of the all-time great comedy casting director.
I would agree with that, yes.
So what was the process? Who was kind of the first person that you got on board, and who was maybe the hardest person to cast?
Ted and Kristen were sort of simultaneous. Mm-hmm. I pitched the show to Ted first, and before I felt confident that I could write the show, I came up with the idea for the world and for the basic premise, but then I felt like I should pump the brakes, and I felt like I couldn't commit to writing it until I understood where it was going.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because of those Damon's words ringing in my ears, but but also just because everything I've worked on before this has been pretty lo-fi in terms of the premise. Like, that's how I was taught by Greg Daniels, was the premise should be kind of boring, because if the premise is boring, it allows the characters and the plots and the dialogue to shine. And so The Office is the lowest fi premise in history, intentionally. And Parks and Rec is a little more premise-y because it's a slightly weirder world, slightly less kind of known world, but it's still people in an office, right? And Brooklyn is a little more premise-y, but it's still people in an office.
Yeah.
And so I didn't feel like I could commit to writing this show until I understood long term, like way out, where it was going.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had the idea for the concept, and then I had the idea for the twist of the at the end of the pilot, which was in the pilot, which is that she doesn't belong.
Mm-hmm.
And Eleanor is there by mistake.
And was the twist from the end of the first season there, though, from the beginning?
That's when I committed to it. Like, I thought it out, and I was like, okay. And I sort of mapped out where I thought it could go. And I thought, well, maybe in the some point late in the season, Eleanor, who has become a better person, you know, volunteers instead of like running and trying not to get caught. She just comes clean.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. But it wasn't until I was like, oh, the whole thing is, it's no exit. It's actually like an experiment, that I was like, okay, now I get it. Cause now I know what season two is, right?
It took me a while to figure it out. But just now, as we were all fighting and yelling at each other and each one of us demanding we should go to the bad place, I thought to myself, man, this is torture. And And then it hit me. They're never gonna call a train to take us to the bad place. They can't. Because we're already here. This is the bad place.
After I had all that, then I went to Ted, pitched it to Ted, told him, I was like, this is going to take a long time to explain, but like, you'll understand why, and pitched him the entire thing. And he was very interested and asked me a bunch of really, really smart questions. And
what did he want to know?
Well, he approaches everything in like the purest sort of like, what am I doing kind of a way, like as an actor, what am I doing? And so the first thing he said was, I totally get why this is a great story. I totally understand why the narrative over the course of the entire season is sort of captivating and this twist is wonderful and blah, blah, blah. But he's like, the problem is when I imagine playing this role, I imagine it might be hard for me because I'm playing one thing. Mm. The thing I'm playing over and over again, episode after episode after episode, is I described it to him as like, you are a, you designed like the Taj Mahal, and then someone comes to you and says like, there's a structural flaw in the Taj Mahal and he doesn't know where it is. And so he's just wandering from room to room searching for the structural flaw. And he was like, I'm worried that I will be doing that for too long. That attitude of like, where's the problem? Where's the problem? It's too much of the same thing. And as he was saying that, I had two thoughts. Number one, he's totally right. And number two, the event that I had imagined happening late in the year, which was Eleanor saying, hi, I'm the problem. You're looking for me. Mm-hmm. Instead of that being the second to last episode, that should happen right in the middle. Like if that happens in the exact middle of the season, two great things happen from that. One is he gets to change his attitude completely in terms of what he's playing. And two is this entire plot like turns on a dime, and suddenly he's like, what the audience will see is, what do I do about this? Like, I have this has never happened before. I don't know what to do. And also then you can play the idea that he is like, well, maybe she deserves to stay here. Maybe I should fight for her. And all of that stuff will make the eventual twist even juicier, because then you can say, well, everything was going perfectly in his experiment up until that moment. Yeah. And then it threw him for a loop, and retroactively it'll be so much more interesting. So he asked a bunch of questions like that about like, how do you execute this? How do I execute this character? How do I, Ted Danson, execute this character in a way that the audience finds interesting, which is a wonderful thing to pose to a writer. So he was interested immediately, and it was like, okay, this is going to work. And then like very soon after that, I pitched the whole thing to Kristen. And she asked me a bunch of really interesting questions. But the best moment of the meeting with Kristen was, she said, who are you thinking of to play Michael? And I said, Ted Danson. And she went, like, got so excited, because it turned out they were friends. They'd been in a movie together. She was obsessed with him. She checked into hotels under the fake name of Arthur Frobisher, which is his character from Damages. Like, they had just done an escape room like the week before together. Like, it turned out they were like best friends, which I had no idea about. Oftentimes in my experience, when ideas get momentum, part of what gives the momentum is this weird sense that the universe is kind of lining up to help you. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge sign for me that I was like somehow magically on the right track. So they signed on very quickly, and once they were in, NBC was like, whoever you want. Like, once you have Ted and Kristen in the show,
it gave you maybe more freedom to cast lesser known people in other
100%
roles.
100%, yes. And it was the whole thing was very smooth sailing. And like you said, when you have Allison Jones looking for people like that, you get the very best people that exist in the world. I mean, she really is. I talk about her in such glowing terms that she is embarrassed by it, but she deserves it. She and her partner Ben Harris deserve all of the praise in the world. And the best way to explain how good they are is, I have a sort of deal with them where I say, I'm going to give you the descriptions of the characters as I imagine them, and if we find actors who don't 100% fit those descriptions, that's fine. I'll change the descriptions of them. Yeah. Like, I'm so much less interested in magically finding the exact person to fit the initial conception of the character in every way than I am with getting the best people.
Is there an example either from this show or from past shows where that happened?
There's many. In this case, in the Good Place case, I said, okay, here's the deal with Tahani. South Asian, but with an Oxford British accent, like raised in England, like a member of England high society, British high society, has to be tall because it was very important in the design that she had to be like, if Eleanor was going to be jealous of her, and Kristen is not tall, and it was very, very important to me that Tahani be tall. And I described her as South Asian Grace Kelly, like, but British, that's what you want, right? And I was like, but again, if this actress is East Asian and tall, that's fine. Yeah. If she's Peruvian and tall, that's fine. Wherever her national or ethnic origin is, the important things are tall British accent.
Yeah.
And then magically, Allison goes, well, here's a South Asian actress who has an Oxford British accent, who's really tall and glamorous and beautiful and really funny, who's never acted before. Here she is. And Jamila was the exact image in my head.
Yeah.
And so that's the magic of Allison and Ben, is they either find exactly the person you're looking for, or if you're not really looking for any one specific person, they find you 50 great people.
Yeah. And Darcy Carden as Janet, obviously a huge find as well.
Yeah.
She's had a really incredible kind of breakout performance and career out of this. And that's an example of a part I imagine that really could have been anyone, because it's not a human.
Could be anyone to the degree that we saw the age range of the people we saw for Janet. I've gotten this wrong before, but I believe the age range was 13 to 65, all genders. At the time, an actor named JJ Toda, who's now Josie Toda, auditioned and was amazing. There were, I don't know how many, probably like 8 women from ages 21 to 55, and probably 8 men from ages 13 to 65 who were on the, like, what you would consider to be like the short list. And that was wonderful. I mean, it made it really hard, because when you open the range that wide, I'm a huge second guesser of my own decision making, and that was like second guess city. But then, like, Darcy just, like, kind of won the audition. Like, when we did callbacks and round after round after round, like, every time I saw her, I don't know what it was, I don't know how to describe it, but, you know, when Janet started in the beginning of the show, the point of Janet was just like extremely pleasant and helpful person. And Darcy in real life is an extremely pleasant person, and they're just, her vibe was right. And that's why Janet ended up being looking like Darcy.
Yeah. But then she ended up having to do so much more than that.
Yeah. Well, that was another thing that I was like, I kept saying to her early on, like, don't worry.
It's not going to be this boring.
There's more interesting stuff. Yeah. But Ted had a funny comment after we did the episode in the third season where Darcy played everybody. Ted was saying that, like, when at the beginning of the show, he was sort of thinking in his head, like, poor Darcy, like, she doesn't get anything to do. And then, like, you jump 2.5 years later and she's literally the only person in the episode.
In the episode, yeah, that's great.
A high neck sleeveless? I suppose this outfit will do.
Are you sure? I mean, wearing a floral print to an infinite void at this time of the nothing?
So where are we exactly? We're not on Earth, right?
That's correct, Cheaty Janet. You're not.
Your real bodies dematerialized when you entered my void, and your essences reconstituted themselves in this form.
Cool. Cool. And when you say void...
Oh, I mean a subdimension outside of space and time, at the nexus of consciousness and matter, tethered to my essence. Does that help?
It does not help.
So I want to jump ahead to this season, I know you want the finale to speak for itself, and I haven't even seen it yet, so I can't speak to it. But we can talk a little bit about this season. And the end of season three, beginning of season four, introduced some new characters.
Yeah.
New humans who are being tested. I just wanted to talk a little bit about them. Specifically, I really enjoy the Brent Norwalk character, who sure. really feels like he's like of the Trump era in some way.
He is.
So can you just talk about where that came from?
Well, you know, the original concept involved kind of trying to pin down four types of bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
For Eleanor, it's selfishness. For Tahani, it's sort of glory seeking or fame seeking. You know, doing things for the wrong reasons. For Chidi, it's a paralyzing indecision, and for Jason, it's just sort of like low level crime.
Yeah.
And so we did the same thing when we invited these new people in. We sort of thought like, well, we ought to do four new versions of bad behavior. Not even bad behavior, but just flaws, like human flaws, right? Mm-hmm. So Simone, who's a pretty good person, has a very specific flaw, which is she kind of forms snap judgments of people. Mm-hmm. Like she's a very smart person who's like a literally a brain scientist. And so she kind of assumes that she has figured you out after not yeah. very long. And
not very open-minded.
Not very maybe. Open-minded and kind of like pretty secure in her initial read of people, mm-hmm. which is a problem because people are multivarious and layered. And then, you know, Chidi was Chidi. John, who's it was a sort of gossip columnist, and like he was a person who like was constantly just kind of snarkily commenting on people, mm-hmm. and like kind of focusing on other people's flaws to mask his own
yeah.
insecurity. That's a pretty familiar trope. But the one, and those came after like a you know, lengthy decisions about human frailty and human foibles mixed with like, well, the bad place is choosing these people specifically to irritate mm-hmm. the original four. Mm-hmm. So John's foibles would have driven Tahani crazy, and Simone was obviously there to make Chidi go crazy. And then we were sort of like, well, it doesn't have to be one-to-one necessarily. Mm. And there is a type of person in America and the world right now that kind of drives a lot of people crazy.
Yeah.
And that's what Brent is.
This is a disgrace. I accomplished something. I wrote a novel, and now my integrity is being attacked. I've been called racist, sexist. I don't have a racist or sexist bone in my body. I am Brent Norwalk, and I'm a good person. I'm in the good place. You ever heard of it? And I'm here because I deserve to be here. I'm here because I earned it by being the best.
Oh, you're ridiculous.
Yeah, and you're a condescending bench.
How would you describe him?
I mean, Eleanor at one point says, born on third base, thought he invented the game of baseball, which has a nice twist on... You know, the phrase is born on third, thought he hit a triple, but it's that the attitude of like, I deserve this. Mm-hmm. Like he was born, he hit the lottery, right? He was born white and male in America to a wealthy family. And if that is he had no control over that.
Mm-hmm.
That just what happened to him. Those are the circumstances under which he entered the universe. And it put him immediately in the top 10th of 1% of all humans on Earth in terms of luck.
Mm-hmm.
And I read this book called Success and Luck. I can't remember the exact title, but it's like Success and Luck and the Myth of Meritocracy. Mm-hmm. And it was written by this social scientist at Cornell. I believe his name is Robert Frank. And he is a guy who was playing tennis with his friend and had a heart attack. And his friend called 911. And as it so happened, two ambulances are reported to a car accident like 1 minute away.
Mm-hmm.
And because two ambulances had reported to that accident and they only needed one, the other one was able to peel off and get to the tennis court, and the EMT saved his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he woke up and he realized he had a revelation, which was everything that happens in my life starting now is the result of luck.
Yeah.
And that made him formulate a sort of theory that people drastically underrate the level that luck has played in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to think of himself or herself as lucky. They want to think of themselves as hardworking, smart, capable people
yeah.
who earned what they have, right? And it's a very good book, and it was sort of the, in some ways, the basis for Brent, or it sort of put a name or a label to this quality that people have, which is they don't want to admit that a lot of this is just luck. Mm-hmm. He was born white, male, and rich in America. Like that. Yeah. I was born white, male, and not that rich in America. My family was pretty modest.
Yeah, still very lucky.
I'm still in the top 0.3% of luck of all humans on Earth, right? So that's the infuriating thing. That's the thing that you see so often amongst white, predominantly white men in America, but some white women too, is they're not, there's no sort of, there's no admission that no matter what they've done in their lives or accomplished in their lives, that they, that the underlying bedrock of their existence is luck and good fortune, and they're not grateful for it. And that blows my mind. Like, as, and so Brent's whole attitude when he arrives there, and Ben Koldyk did such a good job of this, you know, when he first shows up, he immediately launches into this monologue about how it's good that he was dead because there were some women sniffing, there's some reporters sniffing around and talking to some women who have worked for him, and he can't even make a joke anymore, and everything's so PC and blah, blah, blah. And my, you know, I'm not racist. My dentist is a black woman and blah, 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 blah. And then he says, well, wait, where am I again? And Michael says, the good place. And his reaction is, oh, good. Yeah, right.
That makes sense.
Like, it's of course I am. And then when he starts to feel like maybe he doesn't, there's something indicating that he doesn't belong there, he doesn't think it's because I'm not such a good person. Yeah. He thinks there must be someplace better than this, I deserve. So that it's in really, if you had to boil it down to one word, it's entitlement. Mm. He just feels entitled to the world. The world is there for him. He's the protagonist.
And I think the show's asking the question, is someone like this, ultimately, redeemable, which it's not entirely clear for a while.
That was the key, was like when we designed this character, like we did not want to tell a story about how like all people like that need is X and then they'll be fine. Like that it is, they are the hardest people to deal with on Earth, and they are, I don't want to give anything away. There's a small moment in the finale that indicates like, yeah, he's still working.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I'm not interested in redeeming him. Mm-hmm. I'm really not, because people like him, don't often see the light. And so we didn't want to tell a story that was like Pollyanna-ish about like, well, all you need to do is explain to them that you all they need to do is if the scales can fall from their eyes and then they'll suddenly become good people. Like, that's not my experience with people like that. It's not most people's experience with people like that. And so we kind of didn't really pull that punch, and I'm glad we didn't, because I don't think it's a punch that should be pulled.
Yeah. Another thing that got introduced kind of late in the game is the Good Place Committee led by Paul Scheer, which I also find hilarious, that whole thing. And that, to me, reads somewhat as a critique on the other end of the spectrum of kind of overly PC liberal kind of stuff. So,
yeah, it's not a mistake that they're all dressed like hikers from Oregon.
so where did that come from, and how did you decide
that was born out of a general frustration about people that you might consider progressive or liberal, he has a line that I really love in the episode that airs tomorrow, where they're in a negotiation with Sean. And Sean is not only not actually negotiating, but every counter offer he makes is worse for them and better for him. And at one point, Paul Scheer has this line where he says, like, you know, he's right. Sean says, I'm making an offer. You're not even going to negotiate. And Scheer says, you know, he's right. The only reasonable thing to do is to keep giving up things unilaterally until this demon is happy. It's the most sort of overtly political, I think, that we've gotten. And it's just a straight up frustration from that, what I see on the part of Democrats in Congress and in other local governments, where it's this sort of like, we are going to be we're not just going to be reasonable. Like, people should be reasonable, generally speaking. We're going to overcompensate and give, concede. We're just going to concede a bunch of stuff, because that's not being reasonable. Like, conceding all the things that you care about and that you want to fight for unilaterally is not being reasonable. It's being stupid. And it's and it's actually like betraying your own value system. And it drives me nuts. Mm-hmm. And you see it with things, for example, like when Michelle Wolf, I think, made a joke about Sarah Huckabee Sanders' smoky eye look. Mm-hmm. And in incredibly bad faith, Republicans made a huge deal about it. And it's like, how dare you?
Yeah.
This is outrageous. I mean, meanwhile, like there's children in cages and stuff, right? Like it's not an equal offense on each side. And also the joke itself, if you actually read it, wasn't about her appearance at all, right? But a bunch of Democrats were like, you know what? She's right. Like this is a not called for. And she and Michelle should apologize. Yeah. And it was like, what are you doing? Like you're like there's this weird impulse that progressives have sometimes of like, let's be not just reasonable, but overly solicitous of the other side. And even when they're very obviously saying things and acting in bad faith, let's go along with it because that puts us on like some kind of moral high ground and it doesn't help. It's does not help. It does not achieve anything. And you don't win. You don't get anything from it. Like the other side doesn't suddenly go like, oh, well, thank you. That's nice of you. And now we're going to be reasonable back. Like it doesn't work that way. It's a one way street. So that's the Good Place Committee is just like my personal frustration with that aspect of progressivism.
Coming up, Michael shares how his experience ending Parks and Rec informed the end of The Good Place. So looking ahead to the end, you know, you mentioned endings are hard and you've had experience with them on specifically The Office and Parks and Rec, which both had, you know, big finales, series finales. A lot of people were paying attention to and, you know, worried about. And these shows are so hugely popular still. So how did you think about, did those experiences ending those shows inform at all how you went about ending this show?
For the record, I wasn't around on The Office when The Office finale happened.
You were in it, though.
I wasn't. Thank you for remembering. So I was not at all part of the decision making on on that show. I mean, I remember talking to people who were there, and I know how hard it was to... I mean, that ending... that the documentary had aired and that it had affected the way that people behaved in the office and stuff like that, that we were talking about as early as like season three. It was always a question on that show of when should the documentary air? And Greg Daniels rightly pointed out, like the second it airs, everything changes. Like you can't. And so I think he very smartly waited until the last season. But So I don't know what the mindset was with that show and the finale. Parks and Rec was hard, for all of the reasons you would assume something would be hard like that. But also we had sort of primed our pump, by doing a thing at the end of the previous season where we jumped ahead 3 years, sort of like inspired by Battlestar Galactica. At the time, which they did an episode where like they found a new planet, you solely pushed in on a character and then pulled out and it was a year later, which I thought was so cool and revelatory. And we basically ripped that off. but that had sort of primed our creative pump, in terms of how we were going to handle the finale. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we knew even then, we didn't know at that moment at the end of season six, exactly what we were going to do. But having done that, when we were planning the finale, we thought like, well, we've already done this thing where we leapt into the future a little bit, and it was really fun. And it sort of gave us this little creative spark. And so the finale sort of creatively emerged naturally out of that decision.
Pushing further into the future and seeing where people end up.
And exactly. And like, and the idea that like the main theme of that show was like the effect that you can have on people, the sort of ripple effect you can have by just intervening in their lives in these small ways. And so it was a short leap from that thought to the idea that like, oh, this is a story about Leslie doing one more thing for the Parks Department, and then seeing how she literally in the finale like makes physical contact with people.
Yeah, actually, I just rewatched it yesterday just because why not? It's fun. And so it did occur to me she touches everyone and you see into their future. And when I first saw it, I assumed this is what's really going to happen to all these people. But then this time watching it, it did occur to me, maybe this is what she's imagining for everybody.
We didn't really explicitly say one or the other, but I think you're supposed to mostly believe that it is a glimpse into what happens.
Yeah.
Like that was the intent. Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff that happens is a little ambiguous. There's a moment where Leslie and Ben are attending Jerry's funeral.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there is a man behind them who appears to be some kind of Secret Service agent. But it's unclear whether, if that's true, he is there for Leslie or Ben.
Mm-hmm.
And we left some stuff deliberately ambiguous, but the general idea was that you get to see what happens to everybody. And so I don't know, different, every show is different. Every show has its own sort of like set of themes and ideas and stuff. And I think the most important thing I took from that was like, man, this is hard and you really got to think about it. And so we put a lot of time into thinking about the Good Place finale, and it took a lot of hard work from a lot
and
of
because
people.
Of the nature of the show, I mean, you can't do, I would imagine, the same type of thing that these other shows did, which is about more like, let's see where these characters end up, and it's just it's a bigger thing than that.
Yeah, it is. And also, like, the themes of the show are very like intense. Like it's not like, I wonder whether Leslie Nguyen becomes the governor. Like it has a bigger kind of, it's after a bigger fish. And so it took a really long time, and I think we got it right. I hope we did. Mm-hmm. We'll find out.
So the final season, a lot of it has been about this idea of creating a new afterlife. So you've obviously had to think a lot about that throughout the series, and then especially as you do the end. Where are you now and in your own thinking about the afterlife and what happens after we die? And has it changed based on all of this experience that you've had studying it?
I don't know that I had a theory before the show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a particularly religious person. My sort of pat answer from for a very long time now has been like, I don't know. I mean, who
knows?
Could possibly claim to know? I think that ultimately the things that have changed in my personal worldview have less to do with what happens after we die and more to do with what matters while we're on Earth.
Right.
And the show has given me this, and all the annoying reading that I did and that other writers did, has given me a better and more clear kind of worldview about like what matters. Like what are the things that we do that we should do? What are the things we do that we shouldn't do? Why shouldn't we do them, or why should we do them? That kind of stuff, I think, has changed for me.
Mm-hmm.
Not like I used to think it was cool to like rob banks or something and now I don't, but more like why, like what are the underpinnings of why actions matter or don't matter? And that is a joy. Like that is a really enormous gift that this experience has given to me, is like, I feel like I'm not flailing around trying to put a words or an explanation to what I believe about what humans should do with their time.
Mm-hmm.
I now can say like, well, here's why it matters. Like here are the philosophical underpinnings of human behavior and actions and morality and ethics and stuff like that. It is also like you become, if you read enough of this stuff and think about it enough, you become cheaty. Like you become like paralyzed with the simplest moral calculation becomes an agonizing. Yeah,
that's funny. I remember when the show came out, because Michael's character is named Michael, everyone assumed that it was based on you.
Sure.
Now, do you think you have more in common with Chidi after it's all said and done?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, Michael's actually named Michael because my wife and I went to Paris for our 10-year anniversary, and we went to Notre Dame, sending positive vibes to Notre Dame now.
Yeah.
And there's a stone relief over the main entrance, which is Saint Michael, whose job was to measure people's souls and decide whether they got into heaven or hell in the Catholic tradition. And, at the time I didn't have a name for that character yet. And I was like, oh, well that makes perfect sense. Call him Michael for that reason. And it's been this 4-year long uphill battle to tell people like, no, I didn't, it's not an ego thing. I didn't name him after me, but enough people have said like, it has to be named after you.
Yeah.
Right. 'Cause he's kind of a showrunner in a weird way. Mm-hmm. Right.
He's pulling the strings.
He's pulling the strings, he's, and yeah. he's actually kind of writing the scenarios mm-hmm. of the. And so many people have said it that I've actually had moments where I'm like, well, maybe I did kind of name it. Maybe they're right.
So looking ahead, I mean, now that this show is about to wrap up, what is there anything that you have, you know, coming up that you really want to do next? And how maybe has this experience informed what you might want to do next?
So before this show even started, I ran into Ed Helms on the Universal lot, who I'd worked with on The Office, and we were like, we should do something together because mm-hmm. I love him. He's a wonderful guy, and I had a lot of fun. His character on The Office, Andy Bernard, was from Connecticut, and I'm from Connecticut, and he was like a real sweet spot for me of mm-hmm. like a certain kind of Connecticut prepster that I grew up with, and another guy who had some entitlement yeah. problems. But he and I over like 4 years have developed the show together that we're now beginning called Rutherford Falls. It's going to be on Peacock, the new NBC streamer, next year. And it just got off the ground. We're just meeting with writers mm-hmm. for the first week this week. So that's the sort of next thing I'm working
on. What's the kind of general premise of
that show? It's yet another character with entitlement issues. The basic premise is that he is a guy, his name is Nathan Rutherford, and he lives in a town called Rutherford Falls in upstate New York that's named after his family. His mm-hmm. family is like a Mayflower family. He can trace his lineage back, you know, hundreds of years, and there's a statue of his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather in the middle of the town. And he's very, very invested. His entire identity is based on his last name and his family lineage and history. And he, in the pilot episode, the statue sits in the sort of roundabout in the middle of this road. It's a small town. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, 8,000 people or whatever. And because it sort of it sits in this particular spot because that is the spot where his grandfather stood when he founded the town in 1638 or whatever it was. And, but because it's in the sort of like weird median, drunk kids in, teenagers are constantly crashing their cars into it. And eventually the mayor of the town is like, we got to move this statue. It's like a public health hazard. And he's like, you can't, that's the spot where he founded the town. Mm-hmm. Like history matters, things matter, you know, details matter. And he sort of digs in his heels, and that decision kind of leads to this long domino effect of things that happen in the town and to him and his friends. It's a lot about, the exciting part for me is it's a lot about, Native American issues. Like there's mm-hmm. his best friend is a Native woman. There's a fictional Native tribe in the town. And so when he is like, history matters, you know, like these details matter. His friend and other natives in the area are a little bit like, oh yeah, does it?
Yeah. Who's history?
Yeah, exactly. So, it's really exciting. Like there are four Native writers on the staff and the cast is going to be like half Native actors. And, it's a new sort of like experience to like investigate that aspect of America. Mm-hmm. The idea was very organically sort of grown with me and Ed and this woman, Sierra Ornelas, who I worked with at Brooklyn Nine-Nine, who's co-creating with us and running the show. And so that's what's next. And, you know, as to what I learned from this show, like, I think you learn a million things from every show you work on. And I don't know if there's anything in particular, but that show will be much more serialized, similar to the way that Good Place was serialized in a way that like Parks and Rec and Brooklyn and things like that weren't.
Yeah. So what I want to do now is go back a little bit to the beginning of your career and kind of go through some of the credits that we didn't get to talk about. And just if a memory or story pops out that you want to hit on. So I read that the first thing you did right out of college was writing for Jon Stewart in some capacity.
Yeah. So I interviewed at SNL right out of college and didn't get the job, but Steve Higgins, who was the producer of the show, is old friends with Jon Stewart and had run his show on Comedy Central, and sent my name to Jon as like, this, give this kid something to do. And Jon was writing a book at the time called Naked Pictures of Famous People. And for literally no reason, John decided to pay me actual American currency to pitch him ideas for this book. It was like a book of comedy pieces. And over the course of like, I don't know, 6 months, I pitched him 100 ideas. I think he used like sort of like 1/3 of one of them and paid me $3,000, which was the most money I'd ever seen in my life. It was, every year, at some point every year, I think like I should really send John another email and thank him for for letting me pay my rent. That was my first professional writing experience, was pitching ideas to John, none of which he used, and he paid me money, which he did not need to do because I didn't give him anything usable. But yeah, that was my first job, and then he credited me in the book and spelled my name wrong, which was which I was like, this is perfect.
That's great. So then you obviously did end up at Saturday Night Live. You joined the writing staff in, I believe, 1998.
Yeah.
So what was the kind of culture of the show like at that time when you joined?
And so that cast was like Will Ferrell, Sherry O'Terry, Molly Shannon, Anna Gasteyer, Chris Kattan, Parnell and Jimmy Fallon came in right after
me.
Was
Adam McKay still head writer?
McKay was head writer. Yes. McKay and Tina had just been promoted to co-head writer when I got there. They were in like that cast was in like their maybe third year and like had kind of like settled in, and the show is like a sine wave. Like it has like upswings and then it has like down periods and it has upswings. And we were at the beginning of a sort of upswing. It really kicked into high gear the next year when Will started playing George W. Bush Daryl Hammond started playing Gore, and then that crazy election happened. And like suddenly like every, like things you wrote, dumb sketches you wrote, were suddenly being played on CNN and everywhere.
I always think about that because there's this idea that the outsized influence of SNL on politics, and that actually, you know, the way that Bush and Gore were portrayed had some effect on the election.
Oh,
do you buy into that?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it's not even conjecture. Like they've said it did.
Yeah.
Like Jim Downey, who, you know, is the most famous and best writer at SNL in its history, wrote all of those debate sketches, and, you know, Strategery was the thing everybody remembers. But then, but there was an actual news story that Gore's staff, in the first debate, Gore was sighing a lot and he was audibly sighing, and it came across terribly. And Gore's staff showed him Downey's sketch and was like, this is how you came across. Like you've got to change. And then he came out in the next debate and was very was a lot more sort of under control. And Bush had been a moron in the first debate, and then in the second debate he came out and had clearly just like they had drilled facts into his brain. And then Downey wrote a second debate sketch, which isn't as famous but I think was maybe better, where Bush is just casually name dropping the names of like every leader in Zimbabwe or whatever. And Parnell, who is playing the moderator, has a line where he says, "Gentlemen, it's my belief that for this second debate, you have been either highly trained or something." And there's a shot of Bush, and then there's a shot of Gordon. He says, "Or highly medicated." And like those three debate sketches that year were three masterpieces of the genre, I think. And so like being a part of that. Like being a part of SNL in an election year, especially a crazy election year, is a really wonderful and crazy experience. And then the election happens and the world is in chaos. And I wrote a sketch with like three other people that, where it was just Bush and Gore. It was a cold open and they were like, the election hangs in the balance and Florida hasn't been decided yet. So we have an announcement to make. We're just going to do it together. We're going to run the country together. We're going to split it. And then we ran a tape section that was the Odd Couple theme, and it was just the Oval Office and Bush was in there and there was a mess. And then Gore came in and was fastidiously cleaning everything up. And it was like a fine idea.
Yeah.
It was like, more people probably watched that than anything else I've ever written.
Yeah.
It was like crazy because the whole world in times of crisis still turns to that show for what's the take? Like, what's the take of the country? What's the mood of the country about politics? You know,
and I think Lorne Michaels has always been characterized as striving to create balance, not look like the show is going in one way or the other. Did that ever Did you, because I know, I mean, your politics are obviously very liberal. Sure. Did that ever come into conflict with what you were wanted to do on the show?
It really didn't. Lauren's attitude is the show was forged in the boiling cauldron of Watergate, and the attitude of the show is we are skeptical of whoever's in power. That's just the deal. It doesn't matter which political party he or she is in. We're skeptical and we make fun of the person in power. That's the MO. That's the raison d'etre of SNL. And I have no problem with that as mm-hmm. a philosophy. I think that's a very good philosophy. Mm-hmm. I think it's part of what makes America America yeah. is that its art gets to take down its leaders. Mm-hmm. And it's not hard to make fun of Democrats.
Yeah.
Like, even if you happen to side with them politically, like they're, as the Good Place Committee shows, like they yeah. have, they're mm-hmm. ineffectual mm-hmm. frequently and they're ridiculous frequently. So, I mean, I took over Weekend Update in 2001, as producing that segment. And, my first show was the 9/11 show.
Yeah. First show back after.
Yeah.
What was it? A week or two later?
It was probably three. I think there was a show that we were scheduled to go on and then mm-hmm. we delayed a week.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly, but like that was my first show. And, you know, at the time, and then I wrote with my friend Matt Murray and some other people wrote a bunch of sketches that were parodies of that show, Hardball, with Chris mm-hmm. Matthews. And the formula for Hardball sketches was Chris Matthews is insane and Daryl played him. And then it would be like there would be one Democrat and one Republican and then a third person who was just like a crazy person.
Mm-hmm.
And we did one. John McCain hosted the show. And we had Rachel Dratch playing an ACLU lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I am a card-carrying member of the ACLU. I give them money every year. But it was basically McCain playing the attorney general saying, like, we're not going to be happy until there's a chip in everyone's brain that responds to this remote control I have in my hand, like arguing for surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dratch was, they're talking about Guantanamo Bay, I think, and Dratch's character was like, we should arm the terrorists. We should give the terrorists guns because who will police the police? My answer is the terrorists.
Yeah.
Let's let the terrorists police our military. Mm-hmm. And so, and like that was, you know, human rights abuses aside for a second, a crazy thing to say,
mm-hmm.
there were people at the time who were like, we shouldn't be investigating anything. We should have a sort of, you know, our approach should be like, let's just try to understand everyone better or mm-hmm. something. And it was like, well, there's a war going on and
yeah.
we need to like, so whatever the attitudes are, the prevailing attitudes are, the show attacks those attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a good MO,
I think the one thing that may have tested that a little bit is when Trump hosted during the,
well,
during
that's
the
a different
primary.
Story. I mean, that was a critical error, and
yeah.
many, many critical errors were made in mm-hmm. 2016. Having him host was a critical error because it wasn't attacking him. It was tacitly endorsing his
right.
existence
yeah.
and normalizing his attitudes and behavior. And I think, you know, the SNL's also always strive to stay relevant, and Lauren likes it when like whoever the people that are being talked about in the culture
mm-hmm.
come on the show. That's
right.
the deal.
Yeah.
And I think most people were, and he was too, kind of blindsided by the fact that like that can backfire. Like it's never backfired really that way before.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's one thing when Nancy Kerrigan is attacked and
right.
then she hosts the show because like everyone's talking about Nancy Kerrigan. Let's get Nancy mm-hmm. Kerrigan on the show. Trump was a different story and it was a mistake.
Yeah.
I think no one would say it wasn't mm-hmm. a mistake to have to like put that guy in the show and make it seem like, oh, he's just another person that's being talked about in the culture because
yeah.
that's not what he was.
I think maybe if he had done a cameo like other candidates had in the past in one sketch, it would have been a little different. Or
yeah.
I think even people would have gotten mad about that too.
I mean, the problem was he had already come out the day he announced he was president. He was like, Mexicans are bad and
we're
they're rapists. And that should have been disqualifying. Like
mm-hmm.
at that point it should have been like, yeah, sorry. If you're that unreasonable a person, you don't get to be a part of our thing that we're doing
yeah.
here.
Like,
yeah. and you know, that there was the Fallon appearance was a
mm-hmm.
mistake. Like there was a, but I mean, But, you know, it, by the way, it's not just them. Like, Colbert had, what's his name, on the at the Emmys?
Sean Spicer.
Sean Spicer. Yeah. Like, that was a huge mistake. And, when that happened, I was like, no, what did Stephen, what are you doing? Yeah. Like, that's not, like, I think people were still running the old playbook, which was like, we're, yes, they're extreme in their beliefs, but, like, it's still okay to kind of like bring them into the tent and give them airtime, because ultimately the country is reasonable and we'll see them for what they are. Mm-hmm. But it just, they just kept coming. Like they didn't relent. Like they didn't, it didn't change their behavior. Mm-hmm. And so what ended up happening was it seemed like they got normalized. That's the only word for it. Like that, their attitudes got normalized in a way that I don't think they should have.
Yeah. One more thing that I was just going to touch on from the post 9/11 show is that was the famous Rudy Giuliani joke in the monologue.
Great joke. Wonderful joke.
How do you think about that any differently now, or could you have imagined where he has ended up?
I don't know what happened to that guy. I mean, that guy. You know, I will say this: living in New York on 9/11. I loved that guy. Like, he really was inspiring. And the way that he was moving around the city and like holding things together at a time when it felt like the whole world was falling apart. I would have voted for Giuliani happily if he had run for mayor after that. He really did that city an incredible service. In the intervening 20 years, he has lost his mind. Yeah. He has gone off the deep end like 50 different times. And so even though he's now a straight up loon, I still can't bring myself to retroactively be upset at him, because at the time, the things he was doing for New York were so meaningful and made so many people feel better and safe and good. And I think maybe the reason was it wasn't political. Like he wasn't out there saying like, we got to go attack these guys or like, I didn't want to blow up some stuff. He was just like, here's how the MTA is going to work. Here's what we're doing over here. We've locked this down. Like, here's where the first responders are going. And this is up and running. And we got to do that. It was all like, save the city, save the city.
Yeah.
And it was very comforting. So I can compartmentalize with that guy, even though now when I see him, I feel like I want to vomit.
Could a reboot of The Office actually happen? That's up next on The Last Laugh. So we alluded to this a little bit before, but you famously played Moe's Schrute on The Office.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up.
How did that happen?
So it was part of the backstory of Dwight Schrute that he was sort of from a Germanic family, Pennsylvania Dutch maybe, that he maybe had a wing of his family that was either Amish or Amish adjacent. And we were talking about that in the room, and there had been a reality show called Amish in the City that was on for only 1 year. And the awful premise of this show was a bunch of moron LA club kids was on spring break, and they were moving into like a house in the Hollywood Hills. And they didn't know why. They didn't know what was going to happen or who they were just told they would have some roommates, and their roommates turned out to be a group of Amish people on Rumspringa. And they were like, no, what the hell, man? Like, they just lost their minds. And one of the Amish people was named Moe's, and he was this lovely, kind man, young man who had a neck beard and a sort of a low kind of like resonant voice, and was very sweet. And as a gesture of goodwill for his new roommates, like, made them all little wooden toys and gave them to them. And I was explaining how much I hated this show and how heartbreaking I thought it was and how cruel I thought it was to everyone involved. And I told the whole story, and then Greg pointed at me and went, you're going to play Moe's. You're going to be Dwight's cousin. And so, so I wrote an episode early in the second season where Michael's buying a condo, and he makes a joke about Dwight and says, what do you know about owning property? You don't own any property. And then Dwight has a talking head where he says, I actually do own property. I have a 60-acre working beet farm that I run with my cousin Moe's. And as a joke, Greg was like, you're going to play Moe's. And so I put on a fake neck beard. I think in the photo, it was just for a photo that they showed, documentary style. I don't think I had a neckbeard in the photo. I can't remember. But then in the next season, we broke an episode where we went to the beet farm and mm-hmm. it was like, well, Mose has to be there.
Yeah.
Greg made me grow an actual neckbeard. And I don't have my natural beard growth is I don't grow any hair on my cheeks and yeah. I can't grow a mustache. I can grow a full beard under my chin.
Yeah, so perfect.
Perfect. Thank you. Yes, perfect is the right word. So so he made me grow a real neck beard to have an essentially a non-speaking role mm-hmm. in this show. Meanwhile, by the way, I pointed out to him a number of times, BJ and Mindy and Paul Lieberstein and all these people were like on the show and like
yeah.
had major characters where they basically got to play themselves mm-hmm. or some version of themselves. And like,
they all were writers who
they were all writers yeah. and like the show was like nominated for SAG awards and like they won a bunch of SAG awards and stuff. And then I'm like a bearded freak who doesn't get to talk, whatever, put that aside. So I did it. I was like, okay, fine. I'll do this. 'Cause it's part of the joke and I'm being ritualistically hazed and that's fine. But it was supposed to be the first episode we shot, but then we had to change the script for some reason. I can't remember. And it ended up getting pushed. And so I had to have the neck beard for like 11 more weeks than I thought I did. And we shot it in like September, like an hour outside of LA. It was 125 degrees.
Oh my
and
God.
It was like, and I was sweating. I was wearing wool clothes. but also in that period of time, the show got nominated for an Emmy and Greg and I and the other producers went around to a bunch of like Hollywoody events and our picture was taken a number of times. And so now if you Google me, the first like 8 photos you see are me with a giant neck beard. I mean, it's terrible. It was so terrible.
Funny.
And then the writers loved torturing me.
Yeah,
so every opportunity they could, including, but as you mentioned, yeah. the actual finale
yeah.
of the show.
Yeah, it's great. Do you ever get recognized as Mose out and about?
I do, although not as much. Thankfully, not as much as I, you know, the show has had this crazy second
yeah,
wave.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, people must be seeing you constantly.
So. Yeah, but without the neck beard, it's less.
Yeah.
First of all, I'm 15 years older, but also without the mm-hmm. neck beard, I get recognized yeah. less than you would think.
Yeah, with the insane popularity and, you know, you mentioned Peacock, I think there's been a lot of rumors that there could be some kind of reboot, reunion, something on Peacock. Do you have any
I have no intel for you. I think, like, I don't think anyone would ever do that without Greg's at least blessing, mm-hmm. if not outright participation.
Yeah.
Unless he just was like, yeah, go do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant had a really wonderful attitude because, as I'm sure you remember, the announcement that there was going to be an American version of this was met with
yeah.
a loud
yeah.
thud from the
yeah,
critical
I remember
community.
Thinking, oh, that's a terrible,
idea. Yeah, well, that's what I thought. Like, that's what everyone thought. But Ricky and Steven had this lovely attitude, which was like, sure, go nuts. Like, mm-hmm. we made our thing.
Yeah.
There's DVDs of it. They're on mm-hmm. our shelves. We can watch them whenever yeah. we want. Like, this won't retroactively mm-hmm. hurt our version. So I suppose Greg could, and Steve and everyone else involved could potentially have that attitude, which mm-hmm. is like, go crazy.
Yeah.
But it's just hard to imagine. I mean, Greg put so much thought and care into that show. I mean, the reason it turned out not to be a terrible idea was Greg Daniels mm-hmm. in a nutshell. And it's way harder than it seems
yeah.
to do that premise well. Mm-hmm. And so it would take a heroic effort from, if it's not him, it would take an incredibly thoughtful and careful person to execute it properly. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. We'll see.
You got to work a couple times with Joe Biden on
yeah.
Parks and Rec. Why was he the object of Leslie Knope's great affection?
Well, for one thing, he's a stone cold fox. He's older now, but go look at Joe Biden when he's like in his 40s and 50s. He's a stone cold fox. And also his attitude, his sort of political attitude and worldview was very populist. And he loves Amtrak, and he loves kind of he's kind of a fighter, you know. He's like a kind of a scrappy fighter for the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
That's been his like thing his whole career, and so it just became this running joke that Leslie was like, there's one of my favorite jokes we did on the show was in an episode where Anne is helping Leslie set up an online dating profile. And she says, what's your ideal? Describe your ideal man. And she says, the brain of George Clooney and the body of Joe Biden. so it was just like a joke that someone pitched. I don't remember who it was. Somebody pitched like she would totally have a crush on Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And we threw in that one joke. And then as these things often happen, we just threw in 50 more. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, when we did a storyline where Ben Wyatt was in Washington, D.C., we were like, well, we should try to get Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And we got in touch with his people, and they had seen the show. His staff had seen the show. And I think they really liked the fact that there was a character on TV who was talking about how sexy Joe Biden mm-hmm. was. And Joe was in
I think she did him some favors.
She did, yeah, when Joe was in his late 60s or whatever, was talking about how sexy he was. And so he did two cameos on the show. He did one in that season, the one in the finale.
Brian, you must be Leslie Knope. Welcome. Welcome.
You're... My name just came out of your mouth.
Well, yeah, it did.
Well, this isn't happening. This isn't real.
No, it's happening, and I'm delighted to have you here. On behalf of the president and myself, I wanted to...
Oh, Mr. Vice President, I am deeply flattered, but there's no way that I could take over Madam Secretary Clinton's position.
I'm confident you could do that job or any other, but
okay, I will.
Well, the reason you're here is I'm told you've done such a great job in your town and in the state of Indiana, and I just want to say congratulations for your public service.
And I just want to say thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. You're very welcome. You're very welcome.
You're very handsome.
I think we're all done.
Well, you're very nice. Okay. But thank
you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow.
Well, you will.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President.
You're welcome.
You don't let anything happen to him. Do you understand me? He is precious cargo.
We're going to end by asking a question that I ask a lot of people on the show. Who's a person who you've worked with who makes you laugh the hardest when you're with them?
Oh, man. Like, not on screen, off screen?
Off screen, yeah.
Boy, oh, boy. There are many. My favorite part of my career over the last 20 years has been that aspect of it, was mm-hmm. meeting all of these people. They're like Jason Mantzoukas comes to mind, mm-hmm. and Jenny mm-hmm. Slate is another one who like are as quick and funny off camera as they are on it. Polar makes me laugh harder than maybe anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, Maya Rudolph, I think Maya Rudolph might be the funniest person in the world. Like,
yeah.
I don't know that there's anyone who does as many different kinds of things to make me laugh as mm-hmm. she does, both on screen and off. Nick Kroll is another one. Ben Schwartz is
you've worked
insane.
With some incredible comedians. So.
Yeah. There are so many, mm-hmm. Sandberg is amazing. Sandberg is so funny. God, he's so funny. I mean, that is the best thing about SNL is it's nothing but funny people. Like everybody's funny. And so I started from there. Like mm-hmm. when I was interviewing at SNL, we were walking around in pairs mm-hmm. and I was right out of college. I had no business getting hired there. And I remember thinking like, oh, I'm never getting this job because this woman that I'm paired up with is 1,000 times funnier than I am. And it was Tina Fey. And I was right. And and she got hired in July of that year, and I didn't, in July of 97 mm-hmm. or whatever, August of 97. And I remember thinking, like, when I heard that she had gotten hired and I hadn't, I was like, yes, that's correct. Good job. You made the right choice. But I also remember thinking when I went to work there, I was like, I wonder if everybody is as funny as Tina Fey is.
Yeah.
And the answer is not everybody is, because there are very few people who are as funny as Tina Fey,
right.
but everyone is funny.
Like, yeah.
There are, like, Emily Spivey was also a writer there mm-hmm. Who later wrote on Parks and Rec with me. And she's mind-blowingly funny. Like, the number of funny people that I've worked with since day one of my professional mm-hmm. career is absurd. It's a real bounty.
You're very lucky.
I am, man. I'm telling you. Luck, 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 luck.
All right. Thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Michael Schur for inviting us into his office and being so generous with his time today. The final few episodes of The Good Place are airing on NBC Thursday nights this month. Their big one-hour series finale will air on Thursday, January 30th, at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 Central. I seriously can't wait to see what they come up with. If you like this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're really into this podcast thing, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!